Welcome to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, where it's all about slashing your debt, slashing your taxes, and creating a liberated lifestyle. And now, your host, who met his wife while training for the 400 meters in Seattle and is eating gluten-free while lusting after bread, Dave Denniston.
Hello, my friends. This is Dave Denniston, and welcome back to the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, a podcast dedicated to helping doctors like you slash your debt, slash your taxes, and live a liberated lifestyle. Well, welcome back to another throwback episode, season one, episode three. This is someone that's actually been a two-time guest, and I just really learned so many things in this interview. And Eileen really brought it to the table. Here's what we talked about. We talked about the two most critical things that you should do when you get served with a medical malpractice lawsuit and what you should never do. As a matter of fact, this is a little hint for you. You could actually make the lawsuit worse by doing a couple of things that we're going to talk about in the interview. You're also going to learn three questions you should ask a malpractice lawyer before you hire them. And on top of that, how to deal with your malpractice insurance company. We're going to talk about how to deal with a malpractice lawsuit when you're a part of a practice as opposed to a hospital. Pretty important distinction, right? And she's also going to address how other doctors perpetuate the problem of malpractice lawsuits. And finally, you're going to learn what inspired Dr. Brenner to start her blog and where the real money is once you have your own platform. With no further ado, here is the interview with Dr. Brenner. My name is Dave Denniston. Welcome to the latest episode on the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Well, imagine waking up to a loud knocking on your door. It's early in the morning. You don't want to get up, and so you ignore it. And then it continues and continues. Finally, you scramble out of bed, bleary-eyed, wondering what is going on standing outside your door. Well, the sheriff apologizes for waking you up, only to hand you a letter with the return address of a law firm. Your heart and your stomach sink. And lately, I hear a rumbling with many physicians that they are more and more concerned about malpractice lawsuits. Now, of course, every doc wants to avoid being sued, but only a few doctors know what the heck to do once it happens. And that's why I thought I'd bring a special guest to the podcast, Dr. Eileen Brenner, MD, the author of How to Survive a Medical Malpractice Lawsuit, The Physician's Roadmap to Success. Welcome, Dr. Brenner.
Hi, so good to be here. How are you?
Good, good, good. Well, appreciate you making the time to be here today. And, of course, you're a physician as well as an author. So first, just tell us a bit about yourself and your journey. What inspired you to become a doctor?
Well, I've always been interested in math and science, and I actually was wanting to be an astronaut. That was my dream. I remember watching the shuttle takeoff in elementary school, and that was such an amazing event, and I was just fascinated by it. And so I was very much rooted in science and math as my thing, and I kind of got geared towards medicine because my father is a medical malpractice attorney, and he would come home to the dinner table and tell us about his cases, and I was fascinated by all the medicine and what happened and what doctors do and the science and just the whole bit of it. And I ended up doing an internship to see if this was something I might be interested in, and I just being in the hospital, I really enjoyed the interaction with the patients. I enjoyed the mystery of solving every case is like a little detective story, and that's kind of what led me into it.
So this whole malpractice thing, this was something you raised on at your dinner table.
Yeah, I was pretty much born into it, and I would help him out on his cases because I was good at science. I took more science classes at an early age before my dad ever did it, you know, in an equivalency. He was not rooted in science. He sort of fell into it. So I would help him out, and he'd hand me a deposition, and he'd say, I'm looking for this, this, and this. See if you can find it. What do you think? I mean, I was, you know, that was probably in high school that I was doing that for him. So, I mean, it was a pretty early experience that I got exposed to it.
And your dad paid for your medical school, right, with all that nice background, free work you did for him?
No, I got $300,000 in student loans for medical school.
Oh, that's too bad. Nice dad to help out. Well, tell me more about the book. What you had this background, and obviously you knew about it. This is something you're passionate about, something you grew up with. What led you to write it? What prompted you to end up doing that down the road? Because, I mean, you became a doctor, obviously, and you went through that, and that's busy enough in itself. So tell us about that process.
Well, people think that it was because I went through being sued myself, and that's why I wrote it, but that's actually not the case. I did get sued. I won my case. I got sued again. That one got dropped, and
wow.
I was done. Like, I was putting it away in a little corner of my mind, and I was over it. What I discovered was after that time had passed, I had friends who got sued, and they were asking me all these questions, and they didn't even know the most basic things, and I was answering the questions. I was directing them to my dad, and just all kinds of things, and it occurred to me that these really intelligent people are completely clueless when it comes to medical malpractice, and that inspired me to start writing. Plus, I had gone to a writing workshop for doctors because I'd been wanting to get into writing a book and getting some direction, and I had a book idea that I had started, and what I was told by the agents and the publishers who were at that course, they basically said, you need a platform. And if you want to write anything, and I had no platform, they said the best way to start with your local journals and write articles and try to get a basic platform and an audience. And once you have that, then reapproach us and we'll be much more likely to take your idea and publish it. And that was very good advice. And so I came out of that thinking, what will I write about? What will I write about? And because I was writing about healthcare reform. That was not at all the subject. It wasn't malpractice. But once I started writing these articles because of my friend's experience, it occurred to me like, oh, that's what they mean by a platform. I can write about something that I know about that other people want to hear about. No one wanted to hear about healthcare reform, but people definitely wanted to hear about medical malpractice and how to deal with it. So the articles were very popular, and eventually I was contacted by people in other specialties who came upon my articles from it being left in the doctor's lounge or something, and they said, we'd like a book because, you know, we can't access your articles all the time because they're in an emergency physician magazine, but you should write a book and make it more detailed. I would really like that. And so I thought about it and decided to do it.
Cool. Well, let's chat about why doctors get sued. Now, we all know we're in a litigious society, and we all make mistakes from time to time. So take some time just to reflect for me. What are these root causes of a malpractice lawsuit?
Well, I mean, there's a whole host of reasons. One is you're unlucky, of course. Both of my cases, I would say, were not even remotely my fault, but that doesn't really mean anything. There are so many other factors. You're unlucky. You have a 1 in a million side effect that happened to that one patient. Well, just because it's 1 in a million doesn't mean that that patient doesn't feel harmed. So they get angry and they sue. Sometimes specialists throw you under the bus. In fact, not just sometimes, a lot of times they're all high and mighty in their 2020 hindsight. And they're like, that doctor should have treated you better. You should sue them. That happens a lot. And so we're actually to blame in medicine for a good portion of the lawsuits, most, you know, not most, but I would say a large percentage of patients, if you ask them why they sued, somewhere along the line, there was someone in the medical profession who led them to believe that they were wronged. And it didn't just come out of nowhere. Other reasons why we get sued, we're so harried and busy with documentation and we don't spend enough time with the patients. They don't get to know us well. They don't have an attachment to us. Patients get lost in the system, so they want a fall guy. And yes, I mean, in the end, the logical, of course, reason is we're human and we do make mistakes. Now, just making a mistake isn't necessarily medical malpractice. Medical malpractice is when you deviate from the standard of care in your profession. And since everything is based on percentages, a certain percentage of people will have bad outcomes, and bad outcomes aren't malpractice. However, a patient doesn't necessarily see it that way. And since there's no screening process in most states to eliminate lawsuits, then if a patient feels like they're wronged, then they sue. It doesn't mean they'll win. In fact, percentage-wise, doctors win most of the lawsuits. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but I think it's like 80 to 90% of lawsuits are won by the physician. What a lot of people don't realize is for us, for the physician, we've lost the moment we've received that letter. And that's what people are like, well, doctors win all the cases. It's obviously stacked towards the doctor. What are you complaining about? The problem is, and I have a whole chapter dedicated to the psychology of a lawsuit in my book, the moment we're sued, we've lost. Even if we win the case, we've lost. Something has been taken from us that may never come back. And that's why a lot of doctors are in denial. More people should buy my book. It probably should be in medical school so people could read it before they even get to that. But people don't want to read it. People don't want to hear about it. And I get emails all the time from people who have found my website who want advice because they just got sued. And the problem is my book is most valuable if you read it before you get sued. Mm-hmm. And doctors are in denial. We don't want to hear about the worst that can happen to us. We don't want to deal with that possibility, because once we acknowledge that, then a part of us gets lost. And so it's really the minority of doctors who are this proactive and will be like, oh, well, just in case I get sued, I want to learn all about it. Most people aren't like that. Most people are like, well, if I have to ever think about it, then I will, and then and only then. And that's usually when I get contacted.
So let's say that this has happened, that a physician has been served. They've been served by a sheriff or a process server with that dreaded letter. What should they do first?
Well, the very first thing they should do is, if they have an attorney, a malpractice attorney, they should call that attorney immediately. And the reason is because once you've made that contact with the attorney, then everything that you do from that moment on, attorney-client relationship. And so it will help you out later when it comes down to depositions and they start asking you questions. You can say that your attorney can object, saying that's subject to privilege because of our attorney-client relationship. If you don't already have a malpractice attorney, then the very first thing you should do is call your insurance company, because your insurance company will then get you an attorney. And then when you get your attorney, then again, that process starts. If you call your attorney first, then either your attorney or you have to call your insurance company. That order can vary, like I said, 1-2 or 2-1, but either way, those are the first two things you need to do. Call your lawyer, call your insurance company. If you do anything else, go on a website, pick out a book, try to research it, you are harming your case. Do not do anything. Don't talk to it. Don't talk to anybody. Don't ask to pull the medical records. Don't look at it online if you can. Don't Google anything. Don't do a thing. Just those two things. Call your attorney. Call your insurance company. All those other things will get you into trouble, because if you've done research, they will ask about it, and it will create all these lines of questions you don't want to be answering. And all of that can be prevented if you don't do any of it. Now, you can start to look stuff up once you've made that attorney relationship. Once that happens, then it could always be said, well, you were doing research for your attorney and for your case, and therefore it can't be used against you. But if you do that research before that, then it will. And it'll make you look bad because it'll be like, oh, so the first thing you did was try to find out information about how to protect yourself. It seems like they can't find out, but they can, and they'll ask, and you know, and shoot, now they can subpoena all kinds of electronic stuff, so you just don't know what can get, what they can't.
Sure.
So yes, those two things, and only those two things.
And also, I thought it was really interesting. You just brought up the employer, and we don't have to talk about all of this. But in the book, you talk about some of these conflicts, this tension between the employer and the physician, usually the employee, because more and more docs, you know, they're in hospitals now and they're not self-employed. So when malpractice insurance is purchased through the employer, they're dictating the terms, right? How does that work? Tell us more about some of those conflicts.
Well, and that happened to my friends. Their first call was to their employer. And even if you have the greatest relationship with your employer, the fact is that in some way, shape, or form, it's going to be adversarial. Even if it doesn't feel adversarial, you are on opposite sides, or you're at least co-defendants and you're both at risk. And they are the bigger pocket and can seemingly have more power. So, for instance, emergency physicians are usually employed by contract groups. And so your employer is usually the other doctors in your group. It can be obviously an HMO. It can be the hospital. It can be just partners in a OB-GYN practice. You know, I mean, there's many different ways, but you can have this. But I have had friends get into trouble because their first call was to their employer. Their employer found them an attorney that they like who will represent their interests well, but not necessarily your interests well. And they let their employer run it because it's easier to let someone else take control. But the reality is that you should take control. And I mean, I was told by my attorney, because in my case, the employer was sued as well as me. That won't always happen, but it can. And they said, you know, you want your employer to get out of this case. You don't want a big pocket in this case. You don't want a corporation, a faceless entity in this case. You want a person in this case. So it may seem like I'm favoring your employer by getting them out and keeping you in, but the reality is you're not going to leave. The best thing you can do for your case is to get them out of the case right now. So sometimes it seems like they're favoring your employer when actually it's good strategy for you, but if you let your employer run the show, you won't really know that. So you need to have your own attorney if possible. I have detailed all these ways in which you can separate yourself from your employer. But it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to have a different attorney than your employer, but you do have to think about it and consider separating and having your own attorney. And if your employer is the hospital, though, then and your hospital is sued as well, then you absolutely need your own attorney. If your employer is more of a contract group, the person who employs you and they just got pulled into it, it's not so clear. You probably can leave them into the case, but you are the most protected when you have your own person representing you that is separate from all the other co-defendants. That is the best scenario. It can't always happen, or it can't happen easily, is because the insurance company wants to save money. They don't want to spend money on three different attorneys for three different people if it's the same insurance company. So ideally they don't want to do it, but again, I have all these steps where if you really feel there's a conflict of interest, if you really feel there's a problem, then you can raise that. But with a hospital being your employer, then there is a clear conflict of interest, and it happens so frequently. I mean, I can't even tell you the number of stories my father has told told me about cases where everything was going swimmingly until this one moment when the hospital panicked and they said something on the stand that they weren't supposed to say to protect them that screwed the doctor. And the only reason his client was saved was because he was separate from the hospital and was able to defend himself. If they had the same attorney, if that attorney told that witness to say that, well, then that attorney is not really supporting you. So it's complicated, but as I said, the best scenario is you have your own attorney. If at all possible to make that happen, that's the best scenario.
So let's say you're in this process of trying to choose your own attorney, wanting to follow this advice. Well, how do you do that? What should you be asking potential attorneys that you choose?
Well, it's a long process, and it's not very clear, and it's not very easy. But the first thing you should be asking once you are trying to get an attorney of any kind is you want them to be very experienced in medical malpractice. So you want a partner in the law firm. You don't want a junior associate who's trying their first case. You want someone very experienced. Mm-hmm. And even that's not always easy. I mean, a friend of mine had that situation and was given a junior attorney and didn't really like how it was going and was asking for someone else. And they kept saying, why? You know, we don't feel the need. We don't think this case is worthy of it. And you have to really push it. And usually insurance companies want to make you happy and they'll go along with it. And my dad gets all kinds of cases because a doctor chooses him and says, I like that doctor. So I like that attorney. I want that attorney. And they'll say, okay, fine. If you like that, that person, we'll let you have that person. If you don't know anyone, it makes it harder. So if you have friends who have been sued, if you have colleagues, if you know somebody, it's much easier to just get a recommendation and try that. But if you aren't doing that and you've been given an attorney, that's really the first place to start. And then you want an attorney who's experienced at trial work. You don't want someone whose whole goal is to settle the case and make it go away as quick as possible. Because, again, from a doctor's perspective, settling is losing. Unless this is exposure for more than the limits of your policy, if this is a brain damage baby case, $10 million sort of thing, unless this is something that can ruin your entire life and go over the limits of your malpractice policy, then you don't want to settle. If this is a nothing little case, attorneys don't want to deal with it, and they'll say, oh, you know, this is nothing. This shouldn't go to trial. We'll just settle. Well, that's because it's nothing for them, but for you, it's everything. So those, I think, are the two things that I would focus on. But again, there's a lot of things to ask and a lot of things to go through. And I really can't say in this shorter period of time, but you want an experienced trial attorney who's going to take it to trial. And so you can ask for percentages of settled cases or, you know, there's all sorts of ways to ask it, but you want somebody who isn't going to just make it go away. Because for them, it goes away. For you, it's on your record forever because you get into the data bank when you settle. Even if you settle for $1, and that includes arbitration. If you do arbitration because you work for Kaiser or HMO type place and they say, oh, we're going to arbitrate, and so instead of this costing $1 million, it's only going to cost $10,000, well, that's great for Kaiser, but you just entered the data bank. So anytime even $1 is spent on that case by a settlement of any kind, you're in the data bank. If you win your case and they spend $50,000 to win it, then you're fine. But if you settle for even a tiny little amount,
then
that's the problem.
What does that mean, being in
the data bank?
Yeah.
There's a national practitioner data bank, and it records every single person who has had a settlement or a judgment against them. And what it means is every time you apply for hospital privileges, they ask you, and then you have to explain it. And if you have a bunch and your malpractice company may jack up your rates because you've had something against you because you're in that data bank. If you have more than one of these, then they can really increase your rates, or they can drop you or say you can't do surgery. Wow. You're an orthopedist who can't do surgery, not going to be able to earn much of a living. And I have heard of people who've had that happen to them because they settled a few cases that were nothing cases, and then they had a big case. In that case, they lost, and that's it. Now they can't do surgery. So you, I heard of a group in my area who back in the day, before malpractice was quite as scary, settled a lot of easy cases just to get rid of them because they were nothing cases. And then we had a crisis in our state, and their rates went up so much that they could barely afford to stay in business. So you can't take it lightly. You really should only settle for those cases that will put you in major peril. You have to save it for that horrible one. Don't just do it because this was a $50,000 case that really shouldn't have been sued in the first place, and you want it to go away quickly and you don't want to think about it anymore. It's tempting. It's easy, but it has the potential to hurt you in the future because that never goes away. There's no, it's not like points on your license where after 5 years they go away and they're gone. They're not expunged. It will be there for the rest of your career.
Well, I'd like to bring it full circle again and talk a little bit about writing and having a book. And many docs, we hear about burnout quite a bit. I had a podcast a couple months ago about that subject. And I'd like to focus on the subject that so many think that they can't do what they're doing anymore, and they may be looking for a second career. And as a matter of fact, I talk about in my book how it's one of the best tax deductions is to be a business owner. And I just think it's so cool that you're doing that by being an author, and you have your own blog, and you've had a radio show. So here you are with this other income or potential income, and you're doing this. Do you imagine yourself writing another book at some point?
Well, I kind of got into this in a different way. I was someone who's been writing for years and just hadn't gotten to the point where I was ready to publish. I write fiction, I write nonfiction, and I didn't know how to go about publication, and so I went and did a course writing for physicians, part of the SEAK, S-E-A-K series. And what I realized when I went there is I was the youngest person there. Everyone was what you were talking about. I'm burnt out and I want to switch careers and I think I can write, and how do I do that? As far as this being an income stream, I mean, it might pay for one vacation a year. As far as net profits, you have to really be doing this for a while. When it comes to having this supplementary career, I would say do it because you like to write. Do it because you want to help people. Do it because you're helping yourself. And if it generates money, great. That's a bonus. But I wouldn't look at it as, okay, I'm burnt out and I want to be a writer and change my jobs, because the reality is that if that's what you want to do and you're 30, you better start now, because maybe it'll help you in your mid-40s to 50s.
And it takes time, it takes commitment, but it can be fulfilling too, and it can
sure.
be fun along the way, and
oh,
all
absolutely.
Those other kind of things. But it's just a commitment. It really sounds
I've met
good.
A lot of people along the way. I've done lectures. I mean, I do have a platform. And sure, you know, being able to take an extra vacation every year and have it paid for by the book, that's nice. But it's certainly not getting me wealthy, and it was never supposed to be. It's really just something I've always needed, a creative outlet. I mean, even in medical school, I was writing. I just didn't write as much, but I was. So it's you know, it's just one of those things that I've been doing, and if I get paid for it, great. And if I don't, fine. You know, I have a job. So my advice would be, if you're looking to give up your day job to start writing and have that as a career, I would say don't give up your day job. But if you like to write, do it. Take this. I don't even know if they still have that SEAK course, but if they do, take it. It's a great course. You learn a lot about writing and what you need to do to write, and it'll make you better at it if you do something like that, if this is truly what you're interested in. But very few people actually can supplement the career completely. There are so many platforms now, and if you have ideas about blogs, then start a blog. And if it catches on, sure, it can be converted into an income stream. And the best way to get out of medicine, really, is to create your platform and then find people who want to hear you and go on the lecture circuit. That's where the money is, being a consultant. That's really the best way. So what you're doing, what I'm doing, what White Coat Investor is doing, I mean, all those things can theoretically lead to consulting, and that's really how you could supplement your career, because that really is the big money.
The book, the blog, or just the entree to get those other opportunities.
Exactly. And it's accidental. People email, like you did, you emailed me out of the blue. People email me all the time, hey, I'd like to do this, I'd like to do that. Sure, some of them are worthwhile and some of them aren't, but I get contacted all the time about stuff. I've flown to San Francisco to do a lecture because I met someone on Twitter who wanted to hear me lecture about medical malpractice to their residents. That kind of stuff happens, and it's a cool experience. Did I get rich over it? No. I probably sold a few books, and I got paid a little stipend to pay for my airfare, but it was a cool experience, something I would not have had if I had just been going to my day job every day.
Well, I just want to thank you so much for being with us. I think we're out of time, but if people have more questions, how can they get in contact with you? Where can they find your book and your blog?
Well, my book is on Amazon, although I understand at the moment it's sold out, but my publisher insists that it is print on demand, and you'll be able to get it. Also, I do have a few copies you can buy directly from me if you want it autographed, although those will run out if I keep getting offers like I have been of late. And that website is drbrenner.blogspot.com, and you can contact me there. Or I'm on Twitter, and you can contact me, IRB123 is my Twitter handle. So I'm more than happy to answer questions, and I've even done phone consults for some doctors who just want phone advice and paid me by the hour or whatever to help lead them in the right direction because they wanted more than what my book could give. So whichever, but I'm happy to answer questions, and I have definitely emailed with people to give them a few answers to questions or clarifications from the book and that sort of thing. So I'm happy to help if you want to reach out to me.
Well, great. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Brenner. I look forward to reading your next post and hearing about your next book. If you're a physician wanting to tell your story and you're grappling with tough issues like the ones we've been talking about and you want to get on your own soapbox for a few minutes, I'd love to share it too in the next Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast. Make sure to contact me at dave@daviddeniston.com or on my website, daviddeniston.com/physicians. For the Freedom Formula for Physicians podcast, this is Dave Denniston. Thanks so much for joining us, and make sure to subscribe and check in again soon. Have a great one.